is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to Hour 2 here on the Tom Hartman Program. What will be the outcome of the GOP civil war against itself? You know, the media loves to report about how, you know, Biden's in disarray or the economy is tanking or whatever. You know, it's national pick on Biden week, I guess, or year in the corporate media. But what's going on right now in Salt Lake City with the Republicans getting together and hanging out and is really, really fascinating. There's a little bit of backstory to this. I think the backstory is even more amazing. And I'll give you that first. The backstory is that Liz Cheney has raised, in the last quarter of last year, October, November, December of 2021, she raised $2 million from the institutional Republicans. Like George W. Bush maxed out his donation to her. And her opponent, Harriet Hagman, who is endorsed by Donald Trump, raised only $443,000. So, and it's by the way, it's not just Cheney. This is happening to a lot of the Republican candidates who are Trumpies, who are not doing well, who are running against what you might call non-Trump Republicans. Lisa Murkowski, for example, who rejected Trump, voted to impeach him. She has raised over one, this just in the last quarter, just October, November, December of last year, raised $1.4 million. That was twice what her Trump-endorsed rival, Kelly Shibaka, I must be pronounced T-S-H-I-B-A-K-A, Kelly Shibaka, brought in, which was only $600,000. In Michigan, Congressman Peter Meyer, he's a Republican who has been just outspoken in saying we should not be the party of Trump. He's raised $530,000 so far, and John Gibbs, the guy that Trump endorsed to challenge him, has only raised $51,000. In Alabama, you've got Mo Brooks, the guy who wearing a bulletproof vest on January 6th, a member of Congress gave the speech saying, you know, we've got to go fight like hell, right? This is just as whipping up the crowd, essentially. He's got a rival. He's the Trumpy. He's got a rival, Katie Boyd Britt, who is more of an establishment candidate. She's a former aide to Senator Richard Shelby, and she has raised $1.2 million, whereas Mo Brooks has only raised $385,000. All at the same time that Trump is sitting on what we know of at least $122 million, but he's not passing it out to these people. So the Republicans get together in Salt Lake City with this as the backstory, and open warfare has broken out. I mean, just open warfare, and it's amazing. NBC News was reporting about this last night. This is from NBC. Quote, Republican candidates need to make voters' concerns a central focus as opposed to Trump's day-to-day attacks, RNC members suggested this week. Few will put it quite so bluntly, they are loath to antagonize Trump and possibly drive off his hardcore followers. Yet in interviews, party officials showed little appetite for organizing the GOP around Trump's grievances. Well, that's how it started, right? Maybe we can make this the beginning of a move away from Trump. And there was this RNC member, William Palatucci from New Jersey, who said Trump, quote, needs to figure out a way to be constructive and not destructive, help a party raise money, and stay out of the primaries unless there's a really good reason. He stood up at the meeting and said, why are we being dragged into a primary in Wyoming? Other members, NBC News noted, were, quote, upset about Trump earlier saying that the investigation of January 6th should be, they should be looking into Mike Pence. He's the bad guy here. One Republican at the meeting said, Pence is a conservative Republican. If anyone's a rhino, it's Donald Trump. Think about it. Well, that's how the meeting opened, right? With those two things as the backstory. So what happened? Well, the Trump faction won. The Trump faction still controls the Republican Party. And Rona Romney McDaniel, the chair of the RNC, is like totally Trumpy now. And so the Republicans got together and they said, okay, we're going to throw some money to Harriet Hagman. You know, Liz Cheney raised $2 million. Hagman had only raised $400,000. We're going to help make that up. This was McDaniel along with Bossie. Remember Bossie? I mean, David Bossie, the Trumpy guy. He's been on this program. Pardon?
Citizens United.
Yeah. David Bossie was the guy who ran Citizens United, that took Citizens United to the Supreme Court. That was his case. So he's working with the current head of the RNC, and they are just like both totally in for Trump. And this is what Rona McDaniel said at this joint interview with Bossie at a Salt Lake City hotel, you know, where they're part of where they're holding the convention this week. She said, "We've had two members," she's talking about Cheney and Kinzinger, "we've had two members engage in a Democrat-led persecution of ordinary citizens who engaged in legitimate political discourse. This has gone beyond their original intent. They are not sticking up for hardworking Republicans." And that resolution to censure Liz Cheney and give money to Harriet Hagman, her opponent, passed unanimously, or at least it appeared to. It was a voice vote, but there was applause in the room and all kinds of stuff. I think this is really going to hurt the GOP. I really do. I think that this may reduce substantially their ability to win in November. Now, the incumbent Republicans who are hanging on to Trump are trying to hang on to the Trump voters because they know that the Trump voters are the primary voters. They are the base of the party, just like the Bernie voters are the primary voters in the Democratic Party. They're the base of the Democratic Party to a large extent. And the Trump voters will get you through the primary. And that's what they're looking at right now. But I don't think the Trump voters are going to do well. This is a shrinking slice of the Republican Party, as increasingly has been proven that Donald Trump engaged in criminal activity to try to hold on to the White House. He was a traitor to the United States. He engaged in sedition against our government as president of the United States and broke all kinds of laws. I mean, from the Hatch Act to campaign finance laws. Hell, Michael Cohen went to prison for 3 years for a crime that Donald Trump committed, writing a check to Stormy Daniels that Donald Trump signed, and Donald Trump told him to deliver this check to her. And he went to prison and Trump didn't. And I think more and more Republicans are figuring this out, and as more and more of this January 6th stuff comes out, Trump is going to get increasingly toxic, and the party is going to be left with a whole bunch of people who were like, yeah, we loved Trump, but I guess we were fooled. And that's not a great campaign slogan in a general election. My personal opinion, and I may be wrong on this, but I've been doing this a long time. I've been to this rodeo before, and not this specific one, but many like them. And I am of the opinion that after the primaries, by July, August, when the primary season is completely done, most of the primaries will be done by the end of June, especially the big ones. I think the Texas primary is in June. After the primary season, I think you're going to see the Republican Party have to do a double take. Now, maybe they won't. Maybe they'll continue just totally in love with Trump right up to November. I think that's going to hurt them. And, you know, from my point of view, that's good news. So we'll see how this internecine war plays out. But the GOP war on democracy, and now the GOP war against itself, this Republican civil war, not a good thing. I have a crazy alert for you about Alabama schools, and I will be picking up your calls on the other side of this break. It's 14 minutes past the hour. I just hit 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the place where despair is not an option. Get active. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Sean says she thinks that the Texas primary is in March. March 1st. Okay, we'll figure this out. It's 15 minutes past the hour. And, picking up your phone calls. Excuse me. Patrick in Seaside, California. Hey, Patrick, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I wanted, if you'll allow me, to list a few points of concern on my part. And I actually wanted to know your thoughts on what is going to happen to our country if 2022 and 2024 go as badly as they possibly can. because I feel like if you go from November 2020 to November 2022, I feel like I'm on, and we all are, this slow-moving train to hell, and no one's hitting the brakes. My concerns are, well, a few. I don't know how, I don't see a lot of urgency with the Justice Department and the Biden administration. I do with the House of Representatives, but first of all, I think there's a civil war inside the military itself. I'm afraid that if they take power in 2022 and 2024, and they'll get away with as much as they can. I can see Trumpists rounding up all of us, Democrats, journalists, authors, politicians, media people. I could see them executing people in the streets on television I see that's very unrealistic, but I mean, these people, once they get in power,
but you think that's unrealistic? That's exactly what Kyle Rittenhouse did, and he was celebrated by the Republican Party.
Now, I mean, like I said, I think there's a civil war within the military itself. I think you've got a long history, at least going back to the second term of Bush Cheney and the book that came out, Irregular Army, where white supremacists have been intentionally going to military service and getting combat experience so they can come back and become killer cops. I don't know how unconstitutional it is to ban Nazis and white supremacists from service in the military, intelligence communities, and law enforcement.
It is not unconstitutional.
But it seems like it seems like it goes against their oath to the Constitution. Everything they stand for is against the Constitution. The late Mae Brussel was saying this for probably the entirety of her 17-year career in broadcasting, that this goes back to the Project Paperclip Nazis being imported into our government, and including military and intelligence communities.
Right. And in the late 40s, you're talking about when the OSS became the CIA?
Well, but I mean, the Project Paperclip people, you know, Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty and the secret team said, you know, people would be shocked if they looked at the roles in 1955 and 1956 of the American Psychiatric and Psychological Associations. There are Nazis everywhere. Now, I'm not saying that these people actually had physical offspring, but it seems to me that fascists like attract like, and these people don't seem to have trouble finding themselves, and they get together and they plan like 1,000 years in advance. Concerns are, it just doesn't seem like there's a lot of urgency. I don't know. It feels like that Garland has had like at least a year to have indictments. I think that everything we know so far, they should be indicting Trump right now. But so what my questions for you are, what is going to happen? Are we going to just break up into 11 regions like the book American Nations? Is there going to be just, are we just going to disintegrate? Is there going to be civil war?
Pardon the interruption, but we're going to hit the break here in a second. I don't see any of those scenarios playing out. The big divide right now is rural-urban. So
in other words, I shouldn't start a GoFundMe account to move to New Zealand or get my Irish dual citizenship through my father and leave?
Ireland might be good, although they're having their own problems right now with Brexit. I don't think this worst case scenario is going to be what happens. I really don't. Patrick, I'll be right back. Thank you very much for the call. We'll be right back. Welcome back, 20 minutes past the hour. Bobby in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Bobby, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I have an idea I'd like to get your feedback on. We have a propaganda problem, as you know. Fox is a big part of that. And just using them as an example, could we get Congress to hold hearings, bring someone like Tucker Carlson in under oath, and make it clear that he's either entertaining his audience and lying to them, or make him lie under oath and face prison time. The tape, the recorded videotape of sessions like that might be very helpful to the Democrats.
I think that if Congress goes after the press, it will be a bad precedent, number one, although it has happened in the past. And we look back on when it happened in the 1950s with the House Un-American Activities Committee and with Senator McCarthy's hearings as well in the Senate, with some horror. The flag that went up for me this morning was reading this article. I saw the link to it off Drudge. I don't recall where it was published, but it was on Drudge this morning. In fact, it was the headline. That the Discovery Channel is in the process of buying CNN. And the head of the Discovery Channel just came out and said CNN is the leader, the news leader on the left. And I'm like, on the left? And I, you know, I suppose, you know, you could say that, you know, their evening primetime lineup is people who are skewing at least Democratic and somewhat progressive. But, you know, if their plan is to make CNN into a right-wing channel or into a neutral channel, you know, I'm concerned. With regard to Fox, I'm with Kevin Rudd, you know, the former prime minister of Australia, who pointed out that Rupert Murdoch poisoned politics in Australia. He called Murdoch the cancer on Australian politics, then went to England and poisoned British politics or the United Kingdom, and then came to America and poisoned our politics here. You know, Fox News is news of, by, and for billionaires, from, by, and for billionaires and multimillionaires. And I think it needs to be called out, but not in the venue of Congress. That would be concerning to me. Bobby, thank you for the call. Gar in Decatur, Georgia. Hey, Gar, what's on your mind today?
I appreciate your program, Tom.
Thank you.
First, I really want to talk about the violence, but I want to mention a little bit about politics. One thing I think most Americans don't understand, politics in the USA is the largest industry in the world. It's a $1 trillion industry. That's why you have so much. Everybody wants to stay close to the $1 trillion because you're tons of money. You know, they want to stay close to it. But the violence. Okay, I want to talk about violence. Okay, President Biden went to New York to talk about violence. I have to laugh when I hear him want to talk about gun violence. I mean, what's the old saying? The same thing can make you laugh, can make you cry. I mean, during Vietnam, that's when it all really took off, especially in the African-American community.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, like my granddad, he had a shotgun. He had it in the corner. Kids wouldn't go nowhere near it. My father had a gun. He had it in his drawer. We all knew it. No one would go nowhere near it. But after Vietnam, okay, I went into the military. I didn't go to Vietnam, but I went into the military. During the basic training, they used to have us kissing our guns. And you know, Vietnam was actually the youngest war. The average age during Vietnam was like 19 and 20. And they made the soldiers fall in love with their guns so much. And this is when your violence really started, especially in the African-American community.
Yeah, the phrase that the anti-war activists that I hung out with used was, the war always comes home.
Yes, and people just don't understand how it came. I mean, we used to watch Rawhide, we used to watch Rifleman, we used to watch Wagon Train, and you know, they were violent programs, but there wasn't no gun violence.
Yeah, well, and they were also morality tales, Gar. All those shows were also morality tales. I mean, they were not.
But the gun violence didn't take off until after Vietnam.
Yeah.
I know guys in my neighborhood, they used to bring duffel bags home full of heroin because they weren't checking. It wasn't checking drugs back then.
Yeah,
and
they
would sell it. Guys, 15 years old was holding $100 bills and stuff. This is in the 60s.
Yeah. Yeah, no,
and that's when violence really took off.
I get it, Gar, and I think your point about, you know, the war coming home is really, really well taken. Thank you very much for that. Tina in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Hey, Tina, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. First of all, thank you for keeping me sane through COVID, working from home every day.
It's been an honor, Tina.
Thank you. My rant for the day, though, is why are people so selfish that they won't wear a mask? It's been close to home to me anyway, but recently my son and his wife, who are both teachers, obviously they've been wearing masks here in Illinois. They've both been vaccinated, the booster too, and wife was pregnant and she had to be induced around about 5 weeks early, had a lovely baby, and the baby 1 or 2 days after was had COVID.
Oh my.
Positive. And it just makes me sad that, you know, this poor little boy, he's fine now. He's doing great.
Good.
But when he first came home, he was congested. He couldn't feed. Luckily, he had weight on his side. Oh. And I just, you know, why? why do people not understand that it's not just wearing a mask? What about these newborns that we have not, we don't know what's happening to them?
It's because we had a sociopath as president, Tina. Forgive the interruption, but I'm looking at the clock here.
Yeah.
The other thing that I would flag for you is I just retweeted this. Somebody caught Glenn Youngkin, the new governor of Virginia, the Republican, in this store in Alexandria, as I recall. And he was walking around without a mask. Everybody in the store had a mask on except him. And this woman calls him out and says, "Governor, where's your mask?" And he's like, "Eh, you know."
Absolutely. It's just off my chest. It's got off my chest today.
Okay,
also, she donated her placenta for research, which is great.
Your daughter-in-law.
Yeah. My daughter-in-law did. Yeah.
That's great. Tina, thank you for the call.
Thank you, Tom.
And thank you for sharing your outrage. I'm with you. We'll continue with Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program right after this, helping you win the water cooler awards.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
We'll be right back with more talk media for the sane among us. Stick around. And welcome back, 35 minutes past the hour. By the way, remember when the January job numbers came out? We just got the February job numbers. We did not? Should have been. The January numbers. Yeah, okay, here we go. Remember when the December job numbers came out? I was wondering how I was missing this, screwing this all up in my brain here. The December job numbers came out at 199,000, and everybody was like, "Oh, that's so disappointing. Is there a problem?" Well, they just revised those. It turns out December was actually 510,000, and now we've got over 400,000, for January. So the numbers are coming out good. The economy is rebounding. I think that COVID is going away. So, and one other thing I wanted to flag for you: if you cook, and you use spices, Penzies. P-E-N-Z-E-Y-S. Penzies is a spice company, and they publish a newsletter, a monthly newsletter. It's called The Voice of Cooking, in which they have recipes and suggestions and things like that. And apparently their list is huge. But they, in their cooking newsletter last month, they're headquartered in Wisconsin, by the way, they referred to Republicans as racists. And that immediately, of course, produced a backlash from the racist Republicans who started a Facebook movement to boycott Penzies. And 40,000 people unsubscribed from their mailing list. So they're trying to do a little publicity to get new people into their mailing list. So, you might want to check that out. You could just Google Penzies, P-E-N-Z-E-Y-S, and find their website. By the way, they note that 40,000 people who unsubscribed was only 3% of their list, but still, a spice company tells the truth. How cool is that, right? Picking up your phone calls, Randy in Bainbridge Island, Washington. Hey, Randy, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I'd like to draw a corollary between the misinformation pandemic and any drug epidemic. That there are frontline users, right, who are hungry for this and there's a demand. And then you have dealers and distributors and ultimately cartels that create the stuff. And it causes a public health crisis. And I don't know much about the truth in advertising or truth in broadcasting laws, but are there any laws to protect us from this just misinformation machine that, of course, people like Joe Rogan can easily say, "I'm just giving the people what they want, and yes, I'm making a lot of money. I'm capitalizing on this."
I think with regard to this, Randy, we are probably in territory similar to where we were in the mid-90s with the tobacco industry. There had been efforts for decades to get the tobacco industry under control and all this, sort of stuff. And what happened was in the early 90s, individual families who had a family member die of lung cancer, or individuals who had been diagnosed with lung cancer but were not yet dead, started suing tobacco companies for liability, for product liability, basically saying, you told me things in your advertising that caused me to consume your product and your product killed me. And in other words, you told me to do something that I ended up dying from, or my, you know, father ended up dying from, or I will die from. And for a while, for a long while, those lawsuits went nowhere. And then in the mid-90s, a couple of them took hold, and you had this, and then it became a class action, and there was this huge settlement. It was like, you know, what in today's dollars would probably be, you know, a multi-billion dollar settlement. It was hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. My old buddy Mike Papantonio was involved in this thing. In fact, I think it was the thing that really made his law firm. And that was the turning point. That was the point at which the, you know, everybody realized that the tobacco industry was just as dirty as you can get, that they'd been lying through their teeth to us for generations, that it was all about the money. They didn't care if people lived or died. I would think, Randy, that probably the biggest potential liability that these folks in the media and in politics would face would be, you know, a family suing them because, you know, Uncle Ralph died of COVID, and Uncle Ralph was a true believer. The problem that those lawsuits will face would be the same problem that the tobacco lawsuits were facing in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s when they really when they were banging their head against the wall, which is, how do you prove that this particular lung cancer was caused by that particular brand of cigarettes, or that particular cigarettes at all? Because, you know, people get lung cancer even when they don't smoke. And it would be the same argument. How do you prove that Uncle Ralph actually got COVID because of what Tucker Carlson said, or because of what Joe Rogan said, or because of what, you know, Donald Trump said, or whatever? And that level of proof is really, really difficult. It's damn near impossible with regard to criminal liability. But, you know, if you're talking civil liability, it doesn't have to be beyond the shadow of a doubt. It can be just, you know, to the preponderance of the evidence, and or phrases to that effect. I'm not a lawyer. But I keep waiting. I keep expecting to see some sort of a class action lawsuit emerge, you know, out of this. I mean, we're over 900,000 dead people. You know, the Trump death toll.org, you know, is over 900,000 now. And I'm just frankly surprised that there hasn't been litigation up to this point. But that's how I think it would play out. And that's exactly what happened, by the way, with Purdue Pharma. So there you go.
It's an amazing situation of misinformation and the fervor for people who want it, and then those who distribute it and create it. And I don't know Trump's organizations, but it seems like the MAGA drug is his biggest business win
It is. He's making more money now than he's probably ever made in his life, and he's making it by draining the accounts of you know, elderly Americans who don't remember that they just gave him $50. I'm with you, Randy. And you know, and we'll see how it shakes out. It's gonna take some time. Juan in Pacifica, California. Hey, Juan, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Pasadena. Tom, first of all, I really appreciate your show. I want to thank you for all you do.
Thank you.
I want to make an argument here to you, and I think to the public in general, because I want it to be more part of the conversation, that the filibuster and the problems with it fundamentally is that it's an unconstitutional rule that the Senate passed. And House members, rather than endlessly kind of complaining about it every time it becomes an issue, most recently with the Voting Rights Act, could actually bring a lawsuit if they wanted to today and try to make it happen.
Are you an attorney?
So I am an attorney. I've been in practice since 2001.
Cool. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so here's the argument. Basically, the Senate can pass its own rules, and that's in the Constitution. But it's well-established law in this context and otherwise that you can't hide some substantive violation of the Constitution, like upsetting its balance of power, through the disguise of rules. And so that's exactly what the filibuster does. It flips the balance of power in the Constitution on its head by effectively, especially the silent buster, I would say, giving the Senate a supermajority voting power. That's a tremendous amount of extra power that the Senate gives itself compared to the House, right? And so here's the layout for why it's unconstitutional, basically. If you read the Federalist Papers, it's very clear, you can find it at least five or six times, that they wanted majority rule in Congress, both the House and the Senate.
But the Federalist Papers are not law. That was a sales pitch.
Correct, but they can very much go to intent, though, and often are cited in federal cases to kind of demonstrate the intent of something or other, okay?
Right.
And the intent here is, does the Constitution require majority voting in both chambers? And I think the answer is yes. The other aspect of that, the Articles of Confederation were supermajority. It was tearing apart the early country at the time, and there was this specific effort to get away from that. Here's the other kind of very legal interpretation of that. The Constitution has, I think, 6 or 7 times where it explicitly lays out where there is supermajority voting rights. Okay.
Right.
And so the overriding a presidential veto is the most obvious one, and then we recently saw how impeaching the president is another.
Right. Ratification of amendments. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there's this basic premise in law that if something says as to specific things one thing, then nothing else is part of that concept, right? So that's the basic legal argument. You know, I would say it's actually been tried before in 2012 by House members along with some private parties in a case called Common Cause versus Biden. Biden was the named person because as VP, he was
president of the Senate.
Yeah. And so anyway, the case law, there were 4 House members, including John Lewis, that joined that case with Common Cause. I think one of the key mistakes they made actually was including private parties in there and a few others. But regardless, that case actually in the D.C. Circuit didn't win. But there's enough literature now by some very smart attorneys, I think out of Chicago, employment lawyers, but also constitutional lawyers, that make the case as to how this is distinguishable. And I would love to see, I see so many complaints from House members, but basically just pointing fingers, at senators like Sinema, Manchin. In my opinion, these people are in bed with wannabe oligarchs. They're puppets.
Yeah.
They're puppets.
What about,
they're never going to be convinced.
Juan, forgive the interruption. I'm looking at the clock here. About Article 4? I mean, Article 4 in the Constitution says that the federal government shall guarantee the states a Republican form of government. Now, it doesn't say that the federal government itself has to be run along Republican principles. But Republican form of government was widely understood at that time to mean majority rule. So is there anything there, that could be used?
I think that's a great point. Yeah, I think that would have, that could have some room in a lawsuit on this front. That's a great thing to bring up as well. Yeah.
So do you know of anybody who's talking about doing something like this with a lawsuit?
I do. I think if you actually Google Common Cause v. Biden, you'll find the most recent articles. There is actually a growing number of attorneys trying to convince House representatives to do this. I think apolitically, cool. I think it would actually be smart for progressives. So I hope to see it happen.
Cool. I would encourage you to reach out to Ro Khanna, Congressman Khanna.
Okay.
Call his office and see if you can establish a dialogue. Juan, thanks for the call.
Okay.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Or for that matter, Juan, the next time Congressman Khanna is on the air, just call in and you can talk to him directly on the air. It's 46 minutes past that. Or Congressman Pocan, for that matter. And welcome back, John in Hillsboro, Oregon. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
It's about the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
About some years ago, I watched this film made in England, and it was showing the categorically how a thermonuclear war accidentally happens. And this film actually takes place in the Middle East, but it's between Russians and Americans, or NATO. And my hair stood up in the back of my neck about some of the relations of this film towards what's going on now. The name of the film is called Threads, like threading a needle.
Mm-hmm.
You can access the film by just going to research or whatever on your apps and just key in the threats.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you don't want to see the movie, you can Google it, and there's a pretty good write-up about it.
Yeah.
But it's not just about...
Was this a novelization? Was this fiction?
Fiction. It was a docudrama.
Yeah, okay.
There was a narrator telling the people how each stage happens, and also it does a social thing about it, how the people, this happened in, they used a city in England called Sheffield,
mm-hmm.
and they gave all the technical data of Sheffield, and then it was going about the politics about what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And how people were trying to resist it, but of course everything went on a lockdown.
Yeah,
it's not a feel good movie at all. What I'm just trying to get across about how everything, the genesis of about the two sides started to build up, and then something accidentally happens.
Yeah,
and so
that's what happened with World War One.
Well, okay, all right, but this was a little bit more, you know, up to date.
Yeah.
And et cetera. But the whole thing, it had the confrontation of U.S. troops in Russia. And so I was just kind of thinking what's going on right now, you know, on Ukraine. So I just wanted to, I'm just trying to get it off my chest because it's, you know, kind of bringing back bad memories.
Yeah.
But the film was really kind of well done, even though on the technical part, well, you know, you have to think about 38 years ago how, you know, things have changed a little bit technically. But the gist of the film was went into the whole, you know, step-by-step of how things led up to a shooting war.
Yeah.
And then it was just talking about the politics, the people, you know, whatever, discussing what's going on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, I'm just trying to, you know, like...
Yeah, right now, you know, President Putin is in China hanging out with President Xi for the Olympics, and my understanding is that Putin is basically saying, we'll support your efforts to take Taiwan if you'll support our efforts to take Ukraine,
yeah.
Or maybe Xi said it or whatever, but they, you know, this kind of joint communique, I don't know if it was a formal one, but it was in the news this morning. I'm not sure that that's going to raise tensions. I mean, it may even kind of lower tensions, given that it's like, okay, now we've got this Cold War situation. I just don't know. I'm watching the situation with concern. I think the whole world is.
But anyway, visually, this describes things. Yeah. I can't really narrate it. You have to see the film.
I got it.
Okay, thrilled.
John, okay. Thank you very much. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes past, 10 minutes before the hour. And picking up your phone calls here on Anything Goes Friday, Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Not my original topic. I'm going to go to that. But in relation to the filibuster, I just would like to point out Article 1, Section 3, the Vice President of the United States shall be the President of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided, kind of like where we're at right now. And the gentleman should pay attention to the fact that that takes that power, that vested power away from the Vice President. Anyway, my topic...
Oh, that's interesting. Another argument for no filibuster. Good one, Bill.
Yeah, it takes it away. Why give the vice president, the president of the Senate, that authority if they can't use it every time a bill is filibustered?
Yeah, I'm with you.
I got an opinion question for you, but it goes like this. 1876, multiple slates of electors submitted to the Congress. Congress passes 1887. They pass the Electoral Count Act, saying they have the authority to decide which slate to pick. My opinion, Tom, totally unconstitutional. The simple answer was just to say we won't count any slates of electors from a state with multiple slates because we have no way to do it. Patent impossibility.
All right. The problem with that, though, is that the Constitution requires an actual majority of electors. And what happened in 1876 was that with Oregon and the three southern states, I think it was Mississippi, Florida, and Alabama, as I recall, they lacked, both candidates, Tilden and Hayes, both lacked enough electors to hit that 50% plus one.
Well, but where I'm going to is fast forwarding now as I watch this last little machination, this last election, now somehow that's morphed into both houses being allowed to vote on the slate from every state. So my question to you, opinion of course, so what happens 2024 comes, Republicans have got control of both houses, and just blue state after blue state, they just reject the electors. So, nope, we're not counting those. Then what happens?
Well, under the current law, that's a possibility.
But it's really not, because it's unconstitutional legislation.
Oh, I agree with you, and it would probably go to the Supreme Court, but look at who's on the Supreme Court right now.
Okay, one quick point on the Supreme Court. Being as a private citizen can never assert executive privilege, why didn't the first court Trump went to, why didn't the first court that Trump went to say, there is no case here, you're asking me to hear a case about whether or not you have executive power as a private citizen, there's no there. There's no provision in the Constitution.
I thought they did. I thought he had lost every single case all the way up to the Supreme Court on that.
But my point was the court should have never heard the case. He had no standing. What was the standing? I'm an ex-president.
Oh, they should have rejected it on the basis of standing. Huh. I'm guessing that they figured that, you know, this is a former president. This is an issue that is dividing the country. It really needs to have you know, it needs to be heard.
And yet it was Nixon that came up with the whole concept of executive privilege in the first place. So now we're arguing whether or not an ex-president has a power that a previous president asserted, and we kind of graciously went along with.
Are you sure of that, Bill? I thought executive privilege went way before Nixon.
I don't think so. I think it started with Nixon.
Huh.
You can take a look.
Yeah, I would have to look that up. I just frankly don't know. Bill, thank you. Good food for thought. I appreciate it. Saul in Seattle. Hey, Saul, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to call and say thank you for everything that you do. And as a newly politically active millennial, your show's had a great influence on me.
Great. Thank you, Saul. Tell your friends.
You're welcome. Of course. I've been telling everybody I work with.
Cool. So we have 1 minute to the end of the hour, Saul. What's on your mind?
Perfect. I'll make it quick. I don't know how much you know about Greek mythology, but I wanted to point out that during the events of the Titanomachy and how Atlas was punished for fighting against Zeus, and his punishment was to hold up forever the heavens, right?
Right.
And that kind of leads me to my point about the title of Atlas Shrugged. And if Atlas shrugs, doesn't that just mean he's shirking his punishment and his responsibilities, which is so typical of libertarians?
Oh, interesting. I mean, you know, obviously when Ayn Rand used that title, she meant, you know, what's his name, Rourke? No, John Galt. You know, was the billionaires are leaving, basically. You know, the world is going to collapse. The billionaires
right,
are the Atlas
which,
that's holding everything
see,
up.
Right, and that's what we see happening today.
Right. Well, no, I would say, you know, the billionaires haven't gone off to Galt's Gulch today. Instead, they're taking over the government and everything else.
But our ideas that are higher up there are like crashing down, which is why progressivism maybe isn't getting as much steam.
Yeah, good point, Saul. Good point. Hey, thanks a lot for calling.
All right, have a good one.
Yeah, you too. And thank you for listening to the program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.